Hello, this is Science Weekly for Monday the 27th of October 2008. I'm Alok Jha. Coming up, the world's first computer. No, not a Spectrum 48K, but the Antikythera mechanism, more than 2,000 years old. We tackle the big questions that it raises. Was it a Mac or a PC? Plus,
the car will go from 0 to 1,000 miles an hour in 40 seconds, and it will pass through the middle measured mile at 450 meters a second.
Plans have been unveiled for a supercar. It's almost twice as fast as a 1.1-litre Renault Clio. Would you dare get behind the wheel? And Thought for the Pod is back as we jump on board the Atheist Bus, the simple idea which has grown into a small, non-religious miracle.
We could have more ads on buses, we could have alternative slogans, we could take the campaign nationwide, and somebody even suggested a TV ad. So, you know, the sky's the limit, even though we don't believe anybody's up there.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome to the pod, everyone. Now, just quickly, Nell isn't here this week. After last week's revelation that she was statistically the most likely to have germ-ridden hands, we've sent her away for a deep clean before she's allowed back in the studio. We've drafted in Guardian Environment correspondent David Adam. David, I wouldn't touch that mic, actually. Yeah, that's where she was sitting. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks.
And our special guest this week is Joe Marchant. Joe, welcome to the pod.
Hello.
Joe is the opinion editor at New Scientist magazine with a background in microbiology. She's also author of the new book, Decoding the Heavens, Solving the Mystery of the World's First Computer. Now, this is a story about a mysterious bronze clockwork contraption found in the Mediterranean Sea more than a century ago. Joe, the story itself starts with some sponge divers. Take us back.
That's right. Sponge divers, it's autumn 1900. They've spent the summer diving for sponges off the coast of North Africa. They're sailing back in their tiny boat to their home island, which is Symi in the eastern Mediterranean. A storm blows them off course and they take shelter near a tiny barren island called Antikythera, which is halfway between the southern tip of mainland Greece and Crete. Takes a few days for the storm to abate. When it does, one of them pops overboard, goes down to the bottom. A couple of minutes later, comes back up to the surface, gabbling, terrified, talking about heaps of dead naked women that he's seen on the seabed. And the captain of the ship's like, well, what's all that then? Puts on the suit for himself. They only have one between the boat. Goes down, realises that they're actually statues, and it's an ancient Greek shipwreck full of marble and bronze statues that had sunk probably in the 60s BC.
And so he went down, he saw all of this stuff, and it had obviously not been discovered before then. What did he do with that wreck? Did they immediately go down and start salvaging all of this stuff?
There's a couple of different stories about that. They may have salvaged some stuff. The official Greek story is that they did not. They were very patriotic. They went straight to the Greek government, who hired them to salvage the wreck for a huge reward. So they spent 10 months going down, pulling up everything they could. It was actually a very dangerous expedition. One of the divers actually died of the bends. Two of them were paralysed. But what they did bring up was the biggest hoard of ancient Greek treasures ever found.
And amongst it was this sort of bizarre contraption which shouldn't really have been there.
Yeah, nobody noticed it for months. They're so excited about these statues, furniture, jewellery, all of the stuff coming up.
Proper treasure.
Yeah, and then there was just this kind of rock that didn't look like very much that was just sitting in a crate for months until it cracked open. And inside they could see gear wheels and as well as Greek inscriptions as well. And this is, the ancient Greeks weren't supposed to have had clockwork or anything like this, so it just completely amazed everyone that saw it.
Now give us a sense of timescale here. So this is in a wreck where the statues and so on, how old are these statues when they were dated and things? I mean, how old do we expect them to be, and where this clockwork contraption was?
Well, the statues date anything from 2nd to 4th century BC. Some of them were clearly quite old when they were put onto the ship, but the ship sailed in the 60s BC. So this is a Roman ship taking stolen Greek treasures from Asia Minor in the east back to Rome in the west.
And amongst them all was this mechanism. Now, the Antikythera mechanism, it sounds like something that Bond villains would create to take over the world. What actually is it? Tell us what we know about what this contraption is.
Well, it's taken 100 years to work out what this thing is because it's in pieces. You can't really read the inscriptions very well. It's covered in corrosion products. It's been this complete mystery. But researchers, by X-raying it, have now managed to work out what it was. And it was basically a box about the size of a clock that you might put on your mantelpiece, a wooden case with a handle on the side, a dial dials on the front and back. And as you turn the handle, pointers on those dials show you everything about the sky for any particular moment. So the positions of the sun, the moon and the planets in the zodiac. There's a calendar on it. There's a dial that shows you the timing of eclipses, so it predicts eclipses. And you can wind forwards and backwards and basically look at any moment in time that you want.
Now, some might argue, you know, surely the ancients could do this sort of stuff anyway. Why is it so surprising that this turns up at that point? I mean, we've had things like astrolabes, for example. People have designed those where you can look at what's in the heavens and so on, or predict where the movements are. Why is this different? Why is this significant?
Well, the earliest text mentioning an astrolabe is actually the 6th century AD, I think. It's still a long time afterwards, although there are kind of hints that the ancient Greeks might have had them.
So this is much, much, much older.
This is much older than that. The first, apart from this, the first sort of clockwork gears that we see are also from the 6th century, actually, from the Byzantine Empire. So there's nothing like this before or for centuries after, and we don't see anything of the same complexity again until modern clocks appear in medieval Europe, so well over 1,000 years afterwards.
And for the Western world, we assume that technology in this sense, in the term sense of gears and that kind of thing, comes around sort of Enlightenment time or afterwards. So this is predating all of that. When it was found that this was so old, I mean, what do people think? Do they think it was might have been a hoax? Do they think, were they surprised? Or, you know, have there been other things found that kind of support the idea that the Greeks and so on had this kind of technology?
There were all sorts of theories going around. Yes, some people thought it was a hoax. Some people thought that it was maybe a second, more modern ship had kind of sank on exactly the same site by chance. Some people even thought it had been made by aliens. Eric von Daniken, the Swiss author, used this as evidence that alien space travellers visited Earth thousands of years ago.
And left a decayed rock in the middle of the Mediterranean Ocean. That's exactly how you would signal your presence, isn't it? Now, there's a very interesting character in the history of this, the sort of discovery of what this mechanism is. A guy called Derek de Solla Price, and you spend quite a lot of time talking about his life. Tell us a bit about him and what he did to sort of illuminate what this mechanism was.
He was a physicist originally, born in London, but then he became a science historian and was a professor at Yale. He was obsessed with the history of scientific instruments. He thought that the advancement of knowledge basically depends on the scientific instruments that we have for measuring things. Otherwise, there would be no science. So he was kind of tracing these back and heard about the Antikythera mechanism and became convinced that this was the start of it all, that the technology in the Antikythera mechanism had basically survived and then had led to all of the other scientific instruments and clocks and a lot of the technology that we think of today as modern. So he was the first to actually X-ray the fragments in Athens and came up with the first reconstruction of what this is. He was kind of partly right. He called it a calendar computer, and he thought that it showed the positions of the sun and moon in the heavens, which is right, but he missed a lot. And his reconstruction, he fiddled a lot of the numbers when he was counting the teeth on the gear wheels to try and work out how it would have worked. He basically fiddled it to fit with his theory. So although he was the first to kind of work out the essence of what it was, he missed an awful lot that other researchers since have been able to glean.
There's some quite nice details about Price, actually. The fact that he loved the idea of science and measurements and things. And he even measured his wife's contractions when she was pregnant.
Yeah, that was my favourite story.
And then when she didn't give birth at the right time, he was really annoyed that how could the creator have done something so impossible and random?
Yeah, he took graph paper to her bedside and marked the time of her contractions. So that's how obsessed he was with measurement.
A dedicated man. David, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I'm fascinated by this. What I'm particularly interested in is, did they only make one? And if not, why haven't we found any others in far more accessible places?
There were almost certainly more than one. There's a few different lines of evidence that tell us that. One is just the sophistication of the design. This is not something that you could have made from scratch. It was probably the result of generations of work, of people kind of building on the design and making it more and more sophisticated. There were, you know, at least 30 gear wheels in this thing, and it's not straightforward gearing. There's lots of quite sort of technical bits to it. The other thing is that we just, such a tiny fraction of what was made in the ancient world survives today, especially things made out of bronze, because it was valuable and it was melted down and recycled. So if you think of statues, for example, we know from ancient texts that hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of bronze statues were standing in the streets of ancient Greek cities. Now, one of the biggest collections of ancient Greek statues that survives is the Athens Museum, where the Antikythera mechanism is also held, they have 10. 9 of those are from shipwrecks. Everything else was melted down, hasn't survived. So if you think of that ratio, the fact that we found even one Antikythera mechanism, I mean, the chances of that, if there'd only been one in the first place, would be minuscule, so that there must have been more of them.
Mm. And is it referred to in any text? Do we have any clue about who owned it and what they did with it?
There are some hints. They were never taken particularly seriously until the Antikythera mechanism was found. So there are mentions, there was a Roman author and politician called Cicero, who lived in the first century BCE, seen as one of the greatest minds of Rome, loved Greek philosophy. And he wrote about a bronze machine that modelled the motions of the sun, moon, planets in the sky.
That sounds like
it. And he said that it was made by a philosopher called Posidonius, who lived on the island of Rhodes.
Might he have been talking about an astrolabe or something simpler, though?
Well, we don't know that astrolabes were around at the time, and also the way he talks about it, it sounds more like a spherical thing, actually, with pointers. I mean, the problem is he doesn't say how it worked. He doesn't give any more details. He could have just made it up to suit his argument. I mean, that's the problem with stories like this. But once you actually find something from exactly that time that fits the description exactly, then you start to think, okay, maybe this is what he was talking about.
And final question, I have to ask this, was it a Mac or a PC?
I'm going to say it was a Mac because that's my favourite.
Good. That's exactly what we want. All right, Joe, thank you very much. Decoding the Heavens by Joe Marchant is published by William Heinemann. Is it next week?
It's November the 6th.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
With a quick look at some of this week's science stories, here's David and paranoid producer Andy with the News Jam.
News Jam.
Doctors are claiming a major breakthrough in the treatment of multiple sclerosis. Trials have revealed a drug that has halted and even reversed the debilitating effects of the disease for the first time. Existing medications, such as beta interferon, at best slow the disease, but patients who were given alemtuzumab were 74% less likely to relapse and had a 71% lower risk of being disabled within 3 years. But most remarkably, those on the new treatment showed fewer signs of disability at the end of the trial than they began with. Dr. Alistair Coles is among the researchers at Cambridge University who tested the drug.
This drug has been around for many, many years as a treatment for leukemia, the condition where the lymphocytes in the immune system become cancerous. And so it's very obvious in that situation that you would need a drug that would target the lymphocytes and kill them. The big conceptual move was to say, let's take this same drug and take it to a disease not where the lymphocytes are cancerous, but where they're inappropriately active.
The most significant shake-up of embryology laws for 20 years has been approved by MPs. Ministers voted for a series of measures that includes allowing scientists to produce human-animal hybrid embryos for stem cells and use saviour siblings to provide bone marrow or umbilical cord tissue for treating genetic conditions.
The world's biggest publicly funded project to make transport fuels from algae is being launched by the Carbon Trust. It wants to make algal biofuels a commercial reality by 2020. The plan could see up to £26 million spent on developing the technology and infrastructure to ensure that algal biofuels replace a significant proportion of the fossil fuels used by UK drivers.
And psychologists have found that a steaming hot drink may be all it takes to see the world through rose-tinted glasses. Simply holding a warm cup of coffee is enough to make people think strangers were more welcoming and trustworthy, while a cold drink has the opposite effect. The warmth of a cuppa also influenced whether people were more likely to be selfish. We've been speaking to Professor John Barge, who's been leading the team at Yale.
This only seems to affect something to do with generosity and altruism and trust. For example, in our first study, we also asked people when they rated this individual they read about, when they formed an impression of this person, they thought this person was more generous, they thought this person was more trustworthy, the warm kind of traits, but they didn't think this person was more intelligent, they didn't think this person was all these other kinds of traits.
Andy, David, thank you very much for both those. Ian Sample, Guardian Science correspondent, joined us in the pod to talk about one of those stories. Welcome.
Hi.
You're a busy man, aren't you? Listen, the one story we want you to talk about is the drug for multiple sclerosis. It got quite a big play in the paper and in press generally. It's all over the radio and things. Tell us about that a bit more. How significant is it?
It's a really big deal. It's the first drug which has been shown to actually potentially reverse the effects of multiple sclerosis. If you look at what the market-leading treatment for multiple sclerosis, which most people with MS would be on, beta interferon, the most it does is reduces the progression of the disease. What was really interesting, I thought, about this study is they used MRI scans to look at how patients' brains were changing on the treatment over the three-year period. And if you compare patients on beta interferon, their brains get smaller over time. They shrink because the autoimmune attack on their nerve cells in their brain makes their brain essentially shrink. They lose brain matter. In this study, the patients actually regrow brain tissue. Their brains are getting larger from the smaller point that they were at because of the disease. That's never been seen before.
And the drug itself, is it a particularly expensive thing? Is it something that is great, but the National Institute of Health and Clinical Excellence might think it's not worth paying for?
It's well, this is a treatment that's been around. This is the first therapeutic monoclonal antibody ever made. It's 30 years old. It's used for leukemia, chronic leukemia at the moment. I mean, it's not wildly cheap, but it's licensed to be used, and it's a damn effective drug, so it will be used. It's only probably going to be effective for people who are diagnosed with the disease within sort of 3 years of being diagnosed, 3 years probably of having their first symptoms, actually. Often it takes you a year or so before you're diagnosed. But I don't think it's going to be that's going to be a showstopper.
If it reverses the symptoms, is it a cure?
It's not like you take it once and you're cured. I mean, the disease is still happening inside you. You still have the autoimmune attack. What you're doing is you're just coming in and reversing the, you are reversing the damage caused by the disease, but you're not eradicating the disease. So it depends what your definition of cure is.
We're going to leave that philosophical discussion for another time.
You weren't recording that, were you, Andy?
Ian, you can go now. Thanks very much. You can find more information on all those stories at guardian.co.uk/science. British engineers have unveiled plans for the world's first 1,000-mile-per-hour car. Bloodhound SSC will attempt to beat the existing record by more than 250 miles per hour. For 18 months, the team's engineers have been working on the £12 million project in secret. Calculations suggest it'll be fast enough to outrun a bullet from a .357 Magnum revolver. The car was proposed by the new science minister, Paul Drayson, who's a racing car enthusiast. The Bloodhound team plans to have the car built within a year, with the record attempt expected in 3 years. Our very own science correspondent, Ian Sample, went to meet the driver, Wing Commander Andy Green, at a hangar in Bristol. The RAF fighter pilot already holds the current world land speed record. This is a man who seems happy to sit in a seat which is basically welded onto not only a jet engine of a Eurofighter Typhoon, but a rocket booster as well.
There is a crying need for scientists and engineers across the world, particularly in the UK. The people who are going to build our low-carbon, high-technology future need to be at school getting excited about engineering right now. Where the previous car was a bit of a Batmobile, this is Buck Rogers. It's a very long, slim car. It's got a big jet engine poking out of the back, a long, thin tube on top, half a metre across. That is the hybrid rocket, which will give us an additional 25,000 pounds of thrust, giving the car a total of almost 130,000 horsepower. The car will go from 0 to 1,000 miles an hour in 40 seconds, and it will pass through the middle measured mile at 450 metres a second.
What's the fastest you've been in a plane?
I've been fast in that at very high level, where the air is very thin. Down at low level, I have never been as fast as this car is planned to go, because the world airspeed record at low level is only 994 miles an hour. We are trying to go faster than any jet fighter ever has done. This is going to be a huge challenge, starting right now, and of course we've got a lot of technical challenges. We've got the geographical challenge, find somewhere to run this car. We've also got the financial challenge. We're in the middle of what Gordon Brown is trying to avoid calling a recession, and that's a real factor. We need to find the firms who are looking to the future, who are looking to invest in the long-term engineering and reputation of their company and also the country. I'm a fighter pilot. I understand the loads, the speeds, the jet engines. I also understand what makes them work and what looks good. This team, this car, they have it. I am very lucky to be a part of that, and they're going to do this, and I'm going to help them do it.
Science Weekly.
Let's have a look now at what you've been saying about recent podcasts. Last week's was all about paranoia and the dirty hands of those pesky northerners. We're very pleased with the quality of our listeners, so very amusing. Keep it up. Producer Andy thinks you've all been talking about him behind his back, so he's been keeping his beady eye on the blog.
DF100 says, well, there's something new to be paranoid about. Fellow commuters touching you with fecal bacteria on their hands. Base Island wanted the pod to discuss UFOs after new top secret files were released. They think that would have definitely upped the number of comments from the conspiracy theorists. Now this from Dr. N. He said, you'd be paranoid too if everyone was after you. Now, woolly-minded liberal lowers the standards. Give me dirty language over dirty hands any day, he says. Parky DR is paranoid about an insidious plot to sneak random adverts into podcasts. He says, I'm just off for a Guinness. Don't know what you're on about there. Daxol types out the best paranoid quote from the 1995 movie Strange Days. The issue's not whether you're paranoid. The issue is whether you're paranoid enough. GMC Gullock spotted the deliberate mistake in last week's podcast as we poorly tried to recreate the paranoia experiment. I didn't feel any paranoia in that clip, he says, until the Central Line train I was on stopped at King's Cross St Pancras. Now I'm convinced someone's trying to get me on a train to Grantham. And for those of you who don't live in London, the Central Line doesn't go to King's Cross, well spotted. Now, onto our Facebook wall. Jerry Taylor from London says, that wasn't Alok Jar on the podcast. They faked it, I tell you. What is The Guardian hiding? Was it you, Alok?
No.
Okay. Francisco Villicid from Mexico says, someone got it wrong in the maths podcast from the week before. 10 loaves of bread, 9 guys, divide each loaf in 10 pieces, each give 1/10 piece to the 9th guy. The 9th guy ends up with 7/10 and the rest with 9/10. I guess that is why the world economy is so messed up. Even great even great Oxbridge maths doctors get fractions wrong. I think that's cleared that up then. Now, Ben Davols posted this after listening to the fascinating Science Weekly Extra podcast uploaded last week of David Rooney, who is the creator of time at the Royal Observatory Greenwich. Nice podcast about time, except you completely missed what is going to happen when we move off Earth. Are we eventually going to have GMT on each planet we inhabit, or will we ignore Earth time and go with local time to keep it in sync with the standard morning, noon and night? And there's a special request from Claire on the Facebook wall. I really hope you have Ian Sample talking about his story on Anne Summer's chocolate body paint, Willy and Nipple Paint, to quote him in your podcast this week. I almost choked on my coffee when I read that in the paper last Saturday. Not sure what it has to do with science. Maybe Ian has a vested interest.
There's an ew at the end of that.
There's an ew, okay, yes.
I've no idea why Ian was writing about Willy Paint, but maybe he does. He just bought lots of it and he thought to himself, this will be a lot of fun. And then, you know, the recall comes back.
There were some suspicious boxes on his downstairs just now.
Yeah, lots of suspicious boxes.
Downstairs.
All right, calm down. Calm down, boys and girls. Calm down. Calm
Should
down.
I say it again?
Yeah, go on then. I might leave that in there.
There were some suspicious boxes on his desk downstairs just now.
Well, we are all moving buildings, so I keep mentioning this, don't we? But, you know, still. There'll be no Science Weekly Extra this week, which is a bit of a shame for all of you out there. So if you've got anything to say on this week's show, do it either by joining our Facebook group and posting a comment, or leave us something on the blog, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly, and make them funny. This next item was created from a little idea on the Guardian's Comment is Free site, also known as SIF, and it's evolved into a worldwide phenomenon. Now, comedian Ariane Shireen came up with the idea of promoting atheism by advertising on buses. It's after she saw a similar advert promoting Christianity, so she set about raising money for the campaign with the backing of Richard Dawkins. So far, it's raised shedloads of cash, almost £100,000 at the time of recording, at justgiving.com/atheistbus. It's also one of the most commented on articles ever at guardian.co.uk and appeared in the website's top 5 stories for 3 consecutive days. Ariane's been on the TV and interviewed around the world: Italy, Spain, New Zealand, the Netherlands, Brazil, Slovakia, Finland, Norway and Russia. The Today programme on Radio 4 won't let them onto their religious Thought for the Day spot, so we're bringing back Thought for the Pod, open to all denominations and non-denominations. God, him or herself is quite welcome to have a go.
It's been incredible. I've done 40 interviews in 3 days. It's been in the Washington Post, Fox News, The Times, CNN, on Rwandan radio, and I haven't slept for about 36 hours. When I had the idea back in June to put posters about atheism on buses, I never expected anybody to pick up on it. And I've been amazed by how much support there is out there for atheism. I think it's been a surprise to everyone. This kind of atheist campaign has never been done before, as far as I know, and I don't think anyone could have predicted this kind of amazing level of support. The most exciting thing about the campaign is just how positive it is. If you go to the donation page at justgiving.com/atheistbus, you can read messages that are funny, happy and enthusiastic in a way that I've never really seen for anything before. There are plenty of jokes. Some people have even signed up as the Pope, with one of them saying, "You're right, I'm an atheist now and I feel much better." There are also messages of relief and thanks. Several people said that they never realised how many atheists there were out there, and many add that this has given them hope for the future and made them feel less isolated. There have also been calls to take the campaign all over the world to different countries. People have donated from overseas saying, "Please can you bring this to America or Norway or Italy?" And I think it says something about the strength of feeling when people are willing to donate for ads in another country, ads that they might never see. It feels like atheists urgently want a way to express themselves and feel represented, and this campaign has given them a way to make their voices heard. I really hope that the campaign will raise awareness of atheism, not just what it is, but also that it can be a positive and liberating alternative to religion. Hopefully it will encourage more atheists to come out and feel accepted, because they now know that there are so many of us out there.
So that was writer Ariane Shireen. She's the one who came up with the idea for the Atheist Bus campaign. I'm with Riazat Butt, our religious affairs correspondent now. Hi, Riazat.
Hi, Alok.
Well, before we go on to what the official sort of religious response to this has been, there's been quite a lot of responses on the SIF article that Ariane initially wrote. I'm going to read a couple out. This is Pizan One, who said quite early on, as soon as the campaign started, "You must be very proud of yourself. Presumably you're giving no thought to the consequences. If it turns out you're wrong, no, thought not." And Davis also said, "Wow, this makes me chuckle. It's such a pathetic initiative. It makes the religious groups look good. From the probably in the headline to the tiny sums it raises to the point of doing it in the first place. What I find amusing is the jubilation of the atheist evangelicals whooping about their silly little bus campaign like a bunch of Scientologists. Atheists, stop proselytizing and enjoy yourself." Riazat, what are the comments that you can see?
This is from Conf, who says, "Great idea, I'm in for a tenner. Read some of the previous comments. I'm not a fool. I realise a single ad is not going to persuade anyone to change their mind. Rather, I see this as a small and constructive step towards making atheism acceptable and mainstream."
And one more comment. Simon Barrow of the Christian think tank Ecclesia, he wrote a response on SIF to Ariane Shireen's article, and he says this: "For what it's worth, as a Christian, I agree wholeheartedly with the slogan. The first part, anyway. It is indeed most probable that the kind of vindictive sky god caricatured by the new atheists, perpetuated by fundamentalists and subtly compared to flying space teapots by overzealous SIF readers, does not exist." It's good to know. Anyway, Riazat, what have the churches and things said about this campaign? Are they offended, as everyone claims they might well be?
No, nobody's offended. Not even the Muslims are offended. Well, Muslims get offended at absolutely everything, right, in case you hadn't realised. The churches have been very cuddly in their response to this advertising campaign. They've been very welcoming. The British Methodist Church welcomed Dawkins' continued interest in God because it encouraged people to think about his existence. And the Church of England, also in a very cuddly, generous mood, said it defends the right of any group to sort of pursue a religious or philosophical question, but it says, you know, Christian belief isn't about hell or damnation, and you know, you can be quite jolly and joyous if you are a Christian.
One of the reasons for this campaign in the first place is simply that the atheists behind it are saying, look, there's so much religious advertising on buses and so on. Well, apparently so. Around well-funded stuff for things like the Alpha Course, where if you go to their website, you get told if you're not Christian, you'll burn in hell.
That is
both of us. Yes.
I don't care.
There's all this stuff. They're saying that there's all this stuff there. So why not have a group of people who don't believe any of this stuff just saying, you know, everyone just chill out a bit. And, you know, the problems that people perhaps are foreseeing. For example, a chap from Christian Voices on radio the other day, mainly finding it quite amusing. I mean, a lot of religious groups seem to find this either, they're dismissing it. They're saying, as you say, the Methodists are saying, we like to think that it's great that everyone's thinking about God, which is quite a nice way of just saying, oh, well, nice one, pat on the head, well done.
Is it a bit,
is it a patronising?
I think some religious groups are dismissive of it. They see it as a stunt. And I did get a press release from another Christian think tank called Theos, who donated some money. Only £20, Theos?
They donated money.
They donated money because they felt sorry for the campaign because they didn't think they would meet the funding target. Ha!
Well,
but also because it's the use of the word probably, what they're saying is that it's hardly a strong statement. If you're an atheist, you'll say there's no God rather than there's probably no God, which in fact the slogan looks like something the Church of England might run as part of an advertising campaign. It's a very Church of England slogan, the way they've done it. Even the colours are quite
the Church
warm
of England would
colourful.
Not run a campaign saying there's probably no God, Riaz.
Well,
they're
I
not
mean,
going to do that.
Some church advertising campaigns have being quite radical, I use that term in a non-Islamic sense, you know, finding God in different ways, like maybe you'll find him at the bottom of a beer glass or, you know, on your toast or something. So
I'm not sure how to respond to that.
Okay.
Riaz Abbat, thank you very much. Guys, I'm going to ask you both a quick question here in the studio. What you make of this campaign? Joe, do you think it's a good idea or is it a little bit silly?
I love it. I think it's a brilliant idea. There have been some previous attempts to raise the profile of atheism, the idea that atheists should call themselves bright, for example. They're kind of a little bit smug, a little bit patronising, but this has got some humour to it. I love it.
David?
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, I was slightly struck by the idea that the religious groups are patronising the atheist. I think if you're patronised by someone who believes in fairy stories, you're in a...
Well, just where Andy's pointed out that in response to this, or partly in response to this, that the Alpha Course has also set up a Just Giving page. It's justgiving.com/alpha posters, where they want to have bus posters advertising the Alpha campaign. And what's the target? It's £100,000 is the target, and they've raised so far, they've reached 300. And as far as we can gather, lots of people are just paying £2 to have a pop at the opposition.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
Back to our guest now, Joe Marchant, who's written the book Decoding the Heavens about the Antikythera mechanism. Joe, the book itself, is there's a lot of characters in it. We've mentioned Price already, who spent almost his entire life sort of going around trying to work out what this thing is. And you write it in a very sort of, almost fictionalised way. You're talking about his emotions, you're talking about, you know, his frustrations. And I just wonder, as a writer, how you balance listing dry facts about someone's life with making it readable and then not going too far into, you know, working out, because you didn't meet this guy, I'm assuming.
Not Price, no. You're right, that was one of the hardest things about this, was deciding where to draw that line, because if you just list facts in a very dry way, it's really going to be quite tedious to read. So I really wanted to try and bring the story to life a little bit. But at the same time, I didn't want it to be fiction. I mean, everything that's described in there happened. I haven't made up any scenes. All the stuff about kind of what he's feeling and thinking at the time, I've tried, either I know that from things that he's written or there's obituaries, I've spoken to people that knew him well. So I do have a fair sense of kind of what was going on. And then other bits, you know, I know kind of what was important to him, I think, and the questions that he was trying to answer. So just tried to interpret as kind of faithfully as I can what I think he would have been thinking and feeling at different times.
I mean, your day job, you're a journalist, so was it quite hard to sort of shift yourself from being objective to try and get into the minds of these people?
Yeah, the whole thing was very different. I'm used to writing short news stories, 400 words, where you just cram as many facts as possible into a short number of words. But this is completely different. You have to kind of relax a little bit. You're telling a story. So it was very different to what I'm used to.
David, you should get some advice for your first novel. I'm hoping that's going well, is it?
Yes, it is. Yes,
excellent.
I understand Arthur C. Clarke makes an appearance.
Yeah, he's involved in the story. He heard about it in the 1950s and championed it for decades. It appeared on his TV series, Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World.
I used to watch that every week.
Oh, maybe you saw it.
Maybe I did.
And he knew Derek Price well and kind of badgered him into publishing his results. And I actually got to ask Clarke some questions when I was writing the book because I wanted to get a bit of background about his role in it. And he was really helpful, got back to me with some great information. So I was very grateful to him. It's just a shame he didn't live long enough to read the book.
So was he right, Arthur C. Clarke? Was his interpretation correct?
Yeah, I mean, he didn't have his own kind of reconstruction of all the details, but he was the one that basically championed the significance of this, how this was going to turn upside down our understanding of the technology that the ancient Greeks had, and about that he was absolutely right.
Was it a good thing having Arthur C. Clarke on board? I mean, because he's, in some senses, technologically, he's predicted lots of things, and so people would listen, but he's also on the side of science fiction slightly, isn't he?
It's a bit of a double-edged sword, I suppose. I mean, he did help to raise its profile, but on the other hand, if something's on Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World, I think people might think, oh, it's just a kind of an oddball, wacko thing, not something that mainstream historians need to take seriously. And Eric von Daniken writing about it as well with his alien theory, both of those things kind of helped to consign it to something that didn't need to be taken too seriously by scholars.
And then has anyone built a working model of this thing, like a contemporary version that pick up and buy and play with? And
It's not for sale. Michael Wright, the curator that I was talking about, he's retired now, but he's built a beautiful working model of brass, actually, and wood, and you can turn the handle and see all the pointers going around. It's really lovely.
It's just in his house, is it?
Yeah, at the moment it's in Athens, actually. It's on display. There's an exhibition going on in Athens that just started last week, which collects together different models of the Antikythera mechanism that have been made.
And how accurate is it? I mean, how does he know that it's absolutely 100% the same thing, or are there bits that he's had to fudge?
He saw it more as a kind of proof of principle that this thing could have been done. So there are bits from the fragments that remain that we know are correct, but there are other bits where he's had to fill in the gaps a little bit.
OK, well, Joe, thank you very much for all that. Thanks to you and to Ariane Shireen, our other guest this week, and to our bumper pack of Guardian people, David Adam, Ian Sample and Riazat Butt. Andy Duckworth produced this work of Audible Art today. I'm Alok Jha. See you next time.